It'll be too easy to talk about nothing. To talk about nothing. Be too easy to talk like I'm something. I'm ballin', I'm stuntin'. Be too easy chasing the fame. Playing the game, it'll be too easy. But tell them we don't feel that. No, no, tell them we don't feel that.
Well, hey everybody, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. I am your host, Calvin Moore, and unfortunately this week, my co-host, Kent Strath, is not here. He had to work late tonight, and so I told him, hey, just we'll just pass tonight, and you can just show up next week. And by next week, I mean 2.5 weeks from now, because I'm getting married next week, and our rehearsal dinner is next week. Wednesday, so we'll be
minor details.
But given that I never actually get the content to David in a timely manner, I will have 3 weeks worth of content that comes out while I am gone. So that works just fine. But anyway, so because Kent's not here, I'm not going to do the dumbing of humanity segment, and it's going to kind of be a truncated episode tonight. And we're going to be talking about this new movie, Birth of a Nation. Written, directed, starring Nate Parker. The movie is controversial in terms of its content, but there's also some controversy surrounding it regarding Nate Parker's personal life and some stuff from his history. We're going to get into a little bit of that on this episode as well. But before we get started, I guess I should introduce our panelists. First, I will introduce someone who is not here, because he will be sneaking in, because he's stuck in traffic right now. This kind of stuff happens. But Gregoire, who you really don't need any introduction to, because he's been on 4 episodes at this point. But 2 new people to the show. First, on the Skype line, we have Nisi Ask. Nisi, hello.
Hello.
Thanks so much for calling in today.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about who you are, you know. Who's Nisi? Where are you from? What do you do? All those kinds of things.
Well, I do all kinds of things, but I'm originally from Southern California. I'm currently living in Michigan. I'm a speech pathologist for a special education center. In my spare time, I like to get involved in all kinds of things, and that's everything from marches to being an amateur drag king to painting, drawing, playing piano, all kinds of fun stuff.
Okay, jack of all trades, master of all? Master of all?
Just my master.
So, I don't know. I don't think anybody's a master of all, right? Just really good. Are you really good at all those things? Or are you just kind of like a novice?
I mean, I'm going to say that I am, because
if I were to ask your friends, would they say you were amazing?
Yeah.
Okay.
If they're my friends, they're better.
Okay. Well, good. thanks so much for joining us. Last but not least is a new friend on the line, Gabrielle Moore. Hey, Gabrielle.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay. Well, I am a 62-year-old grandmother of 9. And
it's a lot of grandkids.
Yes, and mom of 4 grown children.
Full disclosure: one of those grandkids is my daughter. So this is my mom on the line tonight. Yeah. So pretty cool. There's 9 of them now. I can't even keep up with all these kids that are born in our family.
There are 9 of them.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And so what do you do? What's your background? What's your history?
Well,
just for our listeners, I know obviously.
Right. We are a transplant to Michigan. I personally was born and raised in Washington, D.C., and I was there until I met my husband, and we became a military family. So we've traveled the world, and I never thought I'd be in Michigan for the rest of my days, but I am here. And my passion is genealogy. So I have done a lot of tracing of African Americans during slavery. I would say that I think I'm pretty doggone good at it, in that I am normally able to actually find our ancestors while they were still enslaved. Additionally to that, I'm a work from home travel agent, and kind of like the niche of being able to couple both my passion for genealogy and being a travel agent because my expertise is in the Carolinas. And so I pretty much can help a person who's getting that travel together to knock down every door to find their family and almost get them back to Africa. So I've been doing genealogy now probably on the line about 25 years.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And I remember you had crates and crates.
Yes. She has, I still she has have crates and crates. So.
And she would go on trips to Spartanburg, South Carolina to go through what was microfiche back then.
Yes.
I don't think you really need to do that anymore.
Right. I can just go online.
Yeah, everything's online now. But I remember you going on those trips. But hey, thank you so much for joining today.
And thank you.
David Phillips also coming into the room. He's not necessarily on the episode. Well, he might show up on the episode, but he's doing our sound today. What's up, Dave?
I'm doing good. Just we're going to have all three studios running.
Okay, so, got all three studios running here at Podcast Detroit in Royal Oak, Michigan. So so let's dive right into questions then on this topic. I feel like we're going to ask some hard-hitting questions here. We're not going to beat around the bush about the controversy in the film or surrounding Nate Parker by any means. But first question, kind of a soft lob across the plate. So for those of you who are listening who are just hearing about this film, Birth of a Nation, or don't know what it's about, it is about a slave revolt that took place in Southampton, Virginia, that was led by a slave by the name of Nat Turner. And Nate Parker has recently released a film called Birth of a Nation, which chronicles this story of this two-day slave uprising in Southampton, Virginia. But for the two of you that are on the line right now, or here in studio and on the line, before the release of the film, The Birth of a Nation, had you ever heard the story of Nat Turner before? And can you recall how his story was treated if you had heard it? Go ahead, Macy.
Well, I had heard of it, but I remember, I heard a little bit about it in my AP U.S. history class back in high school. But I remember very distinctly, it was one of the more awkward classes that I had to take in high school, specifically because at that point in time, I was the only black student in the entire classroom.
Okay.
So anytime the history of slavery came up, it always turned into the, let's all look at her and see.
What's Niecy think? What's Niecy think? Okay. All right. Yeah.
But then, even from what I remember, it was kind of downplayed. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, even though this is supposed to be an advanced placement class, and usually we're pretty good about, calling out revisionist history and trying to really delve into what the stories actually were and what the history actually is, for this particular event, it was kind of downplayed, and it was kind of I remember the discussion being something along the lines of, oh, well, would it have been better if they had just waited it out, or was it really that bad? And I remember that sticking with me very specifically because it's like, this is slavery we're talking about. We're talking about thousands upon thousands upon thousands of murders and violence and, things that you wouldn't necessarily think need to be sugarcoated, or rather shouldn't be sugarcoated, I should say.
Right, right. Okay. Gabriel?
Yes. And I agree with you, Niecy. As I was growing up, I heard about Nat Turner. And it was very much downplayed. However, it would, I'm saying downplayed, but they would let you know this was a man much like John Brown who was rebelling against slavery.
He led the revolt on Harper's Ferry, which sparked,
correct,
his death sparked the Civil War.
Right. So whenever you heard the story of Nat Turner, it would be coupled with John Brown. It would be coupled with the people who would try to help people get out of slavery. So if they were a runaway, so the story was all lumped together. These are the people that were against slavery for the various reasons. So yes, but I agree with you, Niecy. It was definitely downplayed, and I still think even up until this movie, was still downplayed. You don't hear a lot of people
Absolutely.
Talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and do you think we need more films about slave uprisings like Amistad and Birth of a Nation?
There should be a balance. I guess that's where I am, is that there needs to be a balance. Again, because I've done a lot of genealogy, I've had the opportunity to read many narratives that were done by the WPA in the 1930s. And often you would not just have people talking about...
Real quick, what's the WPA?
The Workers Something Association. I've
okay.
forgotten
right.
what the
I'll
WPA...
I'll look it up later.
All right. But in reading, there are people who, in their narrative, shared how mean their owners were. They would share how they had been separated. So I've gotten an opportunity to read that there were a lot of former slaves not saying very nice things about their former owners. Okay, so I do think that there should be that balance, because just as Calvin just asked me, okay, so what was the WPA? And I apologize because I don't know the name for the acronym, but I've read enough of the narratives. If he didn't know that, that lets me know that we may have an imbalance, you know, that we know about the good people, but we don't know about the bad people. Okay, so I have had an opportunity to read a lot of narratives, and they weren't very nice people. So there should be a balance that we know that. And we, you know, we say that we know, but it hasn't really been in your face. No. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. How about you, Niecy?
Well, I mean, I definitely think there should be, in comparison to what we already have available, I think there needs to be more. Just because I have seen that as a society today, there is a lot of disagreement with the idea of discomfort. People don't want to accept the fact that, you know, as a nation, we are creating a pretty violent and terrible history.
Mm-hmm.
And by only showcasing stories where, oh, well, you know, this slave or this person deserves to be redeemed, and therefore some white savior is going to come along and save him, it's like, well, but across the board, slavery was atrocious. And to downplay that narrative or to sugarcoat it essentially allows for specifically white people or white American history to kind of brush off the atrocities that actually happened. And it allows people today, when we're discussing issues about racism or when we're discussing issues about history or what we're being taught in schools, it essentially provides an ammunition to kind of be able to dismiss anything or to be able to dismiss things that actually happened as they were.
Right.
I feel like if we have more stories about revolts or have more stories about the actual violence that occurred, it forces people to be uncomfortable. And we can't actually instigate any kind of change or actually wrestle with ideas until we're forced to get out of our comfort zone.
Right. And I almost sometimes feel like when I'm having this conversation with, you know, with my white friends, I think it can be a little difficult for them. And some people feel like, oh, because I know that, I'm defending their discomfort and I'm trying to make things more palatable for them. Our mutual friend Marielle calls it respectability politics, which I'm really just kind of beginning to hear a lot of these terms. Like, I've done this, I've been a part of it without knowing the title for it, right? But I find it interesting, and I always point it out to my friends who are uncomfortable because they feel like I'm saying they did this. You might be reaping the benefits of it, even if you're not rich. You might be reaping the benefits of privilege you don't even understand that you have. But at the same time, when a movie like Braveheart comes out, everybody goes and sees that. And, you know, this is a freedom fighter, and he's freeing Scotland from the iron fist of Britain, right? And it's like, and because Americans can look at Britain and go, hey, we freed ourselves from tyranny from them as well. We can relate to that. That's cool. Common enemy. It's all good. And that's somewhere far removed from us. So we can champion that freedom fighting film, right? But when it comes to, boom, at home, it's not the British that are the bad guys in this. It's essentially, I guess, white people that are the bad guys. It's like, oh my God, the bad guy looks just like me and he doesn't have a British accent. What do I do with this?
We're so often wanting to remove ourselves from anything that would either, even though it's not necessarily a personal attack, it because people tend to want to identify with something. And so by insinuating that there's anything negative or that there's anything not necessarily wrong, but anything bad that they would then associate, they don't want to associate themselves with it.
Right.
You don't want to associate yourself with atrocity. You don't want to associate yourself with violence.
Right.
If I can jump in here, I just want to kind of share something that happened kind of recently.
Yeah, go ahead.
Some of it I've known for a while, but some of it is very recent. when I actually first started tracing my family tree, I spoke with a professor at Duke University. And he was sharing with me that the slaveholder that held my family lost his property because of alcoholism. In tracing my family's migration, I found that one of my family members had made it to Virginia from the west side of North Carolina. And the professor said, I wonder how they did that because it was very mountainous. How did they get to Virginia? Just last week, I was actually looking at the brother of my great-great-great-grandmother and found that he had the name of the slaveholder in 1873 when he married. But by 1880, he had changed his last name. And he had moved from the west side of North Carolina to the east side of North Carolina. So it was putting together what was told to me, that this guy was so mean that they didn't want to have his name. They wanted to get away from him. And amazingly, you will see if you're tracing any kind of history between 1870 and 1880, if they really had a crazy slaveholder, they didn't want to associate with his name. And I've read letters of slaveholders, and you could see, you know, so we have to even envision that, you know, you might have nice people, but we're people, so you're going to get the crazy ones. And so that really does need to be brought to the forefront that, you know, it wasn't all hunky-dory.
Right.
And so it does need to be in people's faces, because one guy said to me the other day, he said, I knew if I kept tracing, I'd find the black people in my family, you know. So it's really interesting to see how many people said, no, they weren't very nice people.
Well, there's a lot of people that would push back and say, hey, you know, look, I don't think anybody, with the exception of people we know are flaming racists, are like, hey, yeah, slavery, that was a good time in our history. That was fantastic. We should repeat that. No, I don't think there's anybody that does that, that I know. I've never had that conversation with anyone. Someone might have those conversations privately, but I like to think the best of human beings. So of some of those people, some have said, hey, look, We have enough slave movies. We have enough slave narratives. Look, we get it. I don't hear anybody say that about like Holocaust movies, but with the slave narrative, it's like, look, we get it. We were the bad guys. We're not going to do this again. Do we need another slave narrative to let us know how bad slavery was, how bad our ancestors were? Do we need that? I mean, how do you respond when people say that? Because in one way, I feel what they're saying, because, you know, Gabriel, I mean, you know, you raised me around predominantly white people, so in some ways I sometimes feel like I think like white people do. Mm-hmm. But I also, as a historian, feel personally those who forget history are destined to repeat it. There's a reason why we talk about George Washington all the time. There's a reason why we talk about Thomas Jefferson. There's a reason why we talk about the Louisiana Purchase. And there were bad parts to all these things, the Trail of Tears and so on and so forth. There are good parts and bad parts to all of it. But how do you feel when people say, look, we've talked about the slave narrative enough. We get it. We don't want to repeat this. We have a lot of things in place, so it's not going to get repeated. How do the two of you respond to when someone says that? Because I don't think anybody's coming from a bad place when they say that. And I feel like those people do get that slavery was bad. But how would you respond? How do you feel when someone says that to you?
Nisi, you want to go first? Okay, go ahead.
I mean, I'm not going to lie. I'm usually the kind of in-your-face person who tends to try to call out anything. I call people out.
Okay.
Because, you know,
when you say you call people out, what do you mean by that? What does that look like?
I mean, so usually what ends up happening is they try to draw attention to the fact that it's like, okay, yeah, suppose that we have enough slave narratives, or we have enough narratives about, you know, civil rights, whatever else. But if you look at it in comparison, the sheer numbers, you know, I usually try to ask the person, it's like, okay, well, think about the number of slave movies you have, but then also think about, like, what you mentioned, Holocaust movies, or revolutionary movies, or all these other movies that pertain specifically to American history as told by white people. And then I also try to counteract that was, how often do you hear about the accomplishments of white people, or, you know, the either politicians or founding fathers, et cetera, et cetera, and how many stories do you hear about the accomplishments of black inventors, about Nobel Prize winners, about revolutionaries who were essentially the ones actually being oppressed during this time period. And then on top of it, usually what ends up happening is the conversations I usually end up having are people who want to dismiss it or say that it's so far removed, it's so long ago, mm-hmm. and it doesn't have an effect today. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of tend to have to remind them, it's like, you realize that, I mean, the Civil Rights Act was, what, 1964, right?
Yeah, I actually just, what did I do? Yesterday, I love how Facebook has the on this day, so you can see what you posted like a few years ago. Last year, yesterday, so whatever today's date is, I don't know, October 11th, so October 10th last year, I met a guy who was 96 years old, and he recounted a story to me of having met someone when he was 10. He met a man who was born a slave. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously there are multiple generations between those two people, but at the same time, this guy is still alive, and he met somebody who was a slave. Mm-hmm. This guy who I met a slave. And that's unfathomable to me, but then at the same time, I have to stop and go when someone says, hey, it's not it's so long ago. No, it's not. For this dude, he remembers meeting somebody who was born enslaved. Yeah, sure, the person they met may not remember being a slave, because, you know, Emancipation Proclamation probably happened when they were a baby, but still, they were born into slavery. So that means that we're not that far removed time-wise. But anyway, that was an experience I had. Gabrielle, your thoughts on that, because Nisi just answered on that.
I think that we are much closer to slavery. If you remember, Calvin, there was a play that you did at your college, and there was a young lady there, and when she finished, I was almost in tears because she was trying to say she didn't understand why.
That was the play where I played Malcolm X.
Malcolm X.
The meeting.
Right, and she felt like, you know, she didn't understand why we were still doing this. And my comment is, you have no idea what black people have gone through so that you have the right to go to an all-white college if you choose to. And Calvin, I was born at a time where my great-great-grandmother was still alive, and she was a slave. Okay, so I'm very close if I was raised, because what happens is each generation wants their next generation to do better, mm-hmm. and they come from a certain thought. Calvin is aware, you know, because I'm his mom, that my mom sent me to private school. She sent me to an all-white school, a boarding school, because she had been raised that blacks and whites should not be together. And whatever it was that white people had, my mother wanted me to have. So she sent me to this all-white school that was a boarding school where most of the kids were very wealthy. Okay, so I'm saying each generation kind of teaches based upon the experiences that they have had. So we're very, very close to slavery. If I can tell you that I met a former slave, I'm 62, and my great-great-grandmother was still alive when I was a child, okay, and taught me to pray every day. So I got my training, which Calvin would explain how you ended up in a predominantly white environment all of your life because of how I was raised. So we're very close to that, you know, that time. And so we can't let people forget. We can't let the next generation forget. This is what our people went through to get the rights that you have,
right,
whether it is the right to vote or choose not to.
Right.
You know, at one time, we didn't have the right.
Right.
So now we have the right to do either one.
Right. The interesting thing is the young lady who had said that, I was dating her at the time, or trying to date. trying to date her. And my mom was like, after that, she was like, I don't like that girl at all. But the funny thing is, she was black.
Yes, she was
a black young lady, and I think it was very surprising for you to hear that. Like, my dad was upset at what she said, my mom was upset at what she said, and that relationship did not last more than a week after that. But that's neither here nor there. Okay, so here's a question. So I mentioned Braveheart, and that's one of my all-time favorite films, but one of the things I have been told is that the movie is not necessarily historically accurate. It's a great film, won Best Picture, but it was not historically accurate. And so when it comes to this film, Nate Parker is The Birth of a Nation, it's not necessarily historically accurate, but it does make use of certain themes that happened to many black people during slavery, not specifically to Nat Turner. For instance, in the film, instead of Nat's family being sold away from him, as he says in his confession, so the original historical document that we know about his story, they depict her being raped, which sets off a chain of events that leads to the slave uprising in the film. Do you think something is lost in translation when a director or actor or whoever is in charge of making these kinds of choices opts for themes rather than accuracy, especially when dealing with a contentious issue like slavery? Do you think you should be as close to historically accurate as possible, or do you feel like it was a good thing for them to showcase some things that didn't necessarily happen to Nat, but definitely were happening to a lot of black people at the time?
Thoughts? Well, I think this is where it gets a little bit tricky, because if, for example, we had more storylines, or if we had more films about slavery or any other kind of contentious issue, then using the thematic element might be enough to essentially get the idea across. Mm-hmm. However, because there are so few stories far and in between, when thinking about the audience that you're trying to appeal to, or even just trying to attempt to educate or feel or something, I definitely think that it can be used against the film or against what it's trying to accomplish, because then people will write it off as, well, that's not historically accurate, so I can kind of dismiss it because it's not necessarily based on facts. And, you know, I feel like people who are in power, people who don't want to acknowledge the historical relevance of the movie, will essentially take that small fact and run with it and allow it to be the reason why they're not going to acknowledge the atrocity or not acknowledge the relevance that it has to us.
Okay.
I agree with you, Niecy. Absolutely.
Okay. So then let's not avoid the topic of some of the other controversy that's surrounding this film. So I found it interesting watching the film, knowing the controversy that's surrounding it, because he chose to use a rape scene. And again, the rape scene isn't what actually happened in real life. They sold his wife, sold his son. But he uses this as a vehicle. However, the controversy surrounding the film itself, the director, Nate Parker, were some allegations of rape that happened a number of years ago. And he was exonerated, but a few years ago, recently, the young lady in question committed suicide. And let's just say Nate Parker's response to that has been less than stellar. And so that has that's brought up a lot of boycotts. Boycotts have ensued, and so now there's this tension between protesting to support women, especially black women. As we know, many women get raped. Black women get raped, and a lot of these things go unreported because nobody believes them, or women get chastised. What did you do wrong? What were you wearing? Where were you? What were you doing in that part of town? And so on and so forth. And there's even a historical precedent where women, if you were out after a certain time, were convicted of prostitution. Didn't matter what you were doing. And so there's this kind of history that goes back with that. So there's now this tension between protesting to support women, especially black women, and supporting a story that needs to be told. The story of Nat Turner is a very important story, needs to be told, but then the director, writer, star of the film was also accused of rape, exonerated, but ultimately the young lady took her own life. How were the two of you? I know Niecy, I mean, spoiler alert, Niecy has not seen the film. Gabrielle, you have seen the film. So how were the two of you, knowing that, navigating those waters?
I personally separate, I think, the artist from the art.
Okay.
What I went in looking for was the historical accuracy. And like I said, and you said that he took license with what
right.
he did. Okay, so it was based upon a true story. So
most of it was true. Most of it was accurate.
Yes,
but there were a few things he was like, I'm going to play this theme
just,
here.
Right.
Fill in the gaps.
So in this, I think that, you know, maybe he did take, like, this really did happen in slavery. Okay, and he was trying to take bits and pieces. And Niecy, I kind of agree with you, because things are so few and far between, it is better to stay as close to historically accurate so that people don't say, well, I can blow this off because that really wasn't true. That didn't really happen. They were only doing it to elicit a particular emotion, you know, so then they discount it. So I'm so there with you, Niecy, on your point there. And again, bring it right back to the reason why we need more, because then one movie could address, you know, a particular way things were done, and another might focus on another, you know. Mm-hmm. So I have to admit, in this situation, that I went in separating the artist from the art. I wanted to know how much of the story I would see in history, because, you know, am I going to take my grandchild to see this? You
right.
know? So.
Niecy?
Well, I mean, I've been at a crossroads about this particular film, specifically because of this controversy. Because on the one hand, you have, you know, like you were saying, a story that needs to be told. We need to be able to support narratives that aren't necessarily out there for mass consumption. However, there's also been a trend, and I'm thinking specifically of, for example, Bill Cosby's case, and a couple of, you know, Chris Brown, a couple of other, you know, black men who have been accused of rape, who have been accused and tried for sexual assault. And our unwillingness, and most of this is just rape culture in general, but our unwillingness to hold these men accountable. And so,
right, because that's Bill Cosby from the Cosby Show, right? Can't we just let that go? Because he's putting pops, you know, and he's Bill Cosby, he's family oriented,
right?
So yeah, I heard that. And some, I'm not going to lie, and this might just be blind spots I have as a man, but also as a black man looking at, you know, I look at someone like a Bill Cosby, and I'm going, okay, one, I grew up with him. Living in Japan for 4 years, there were very few shows that came on in English. The Cosby Show and A Different World were two of them. And so growing up, that was like, you know, a second dad in our home. And so now, you know, come to find out, yeah, that's a character he played. And you know, it, at bottom, it's a character he played. But it's hard to let go of, you know, who infused that character.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bill Cosby, when that came up, I found myself fighting, because I'm going, if someone raped my daughter, you know, I have a 14-year-old daughter, I'd want that person to serve all the time in prison that they could possibly serve, and I mean the rest of their life. You know, when I hear about what happened with Brock Turner getting out, you know, for after 3 months, you know, I've got stuff in my fridge that's been there longer than Brock was in prison. And so, not even prison, he went to jail, not even prison. So when I look at someone like a Bill Cosby, there's this, I feel a tension within myself, because I'm going, yes, wait a minute, hold on, he raped people, so he needs to be held accountable for that. But at the same time, I'm going, we don't have that many black role models.
Yeah.
And so I want to let it slide. And I hate myself for even thinking that for a millisecond, because most of me thinks, no, he needs to be held accountable. I don't care how old he is, he needs to be held accountable. But there was a split second in there, sometimes multiple split seconds, where I'm thinking, can't we have just one good role model? Can't we just let this one slide the way that a lot of black people let OJ slide? Like, we know he murdered her. But like, can't we just get away with one? That's kind of the idea. But go on, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting your thought, but I'm agreeing with what you were saying there.
No, and that's actually kind of the route I wanted to go along, is the fact that we don't have a whole lot of role models in that sphere, especially when it comes to, you know, mass media for movies or music or whatever else. And so, at least for me personally, I try to think of it in the sense of, okay, well, yes, this person has had a really wide influence in terms of their art form. However, I feel like it is also our responsibility to hold those same people accountable, specifically because you don't want to turn it into, I used to think of the ramifications of letting things slide, because it just goes right back right. into the idea of, okay, well, we can use this to dismiss everything and everything you complain about because you let, you know, so-and-so get away with weight, or you let so-and-so get away with whatever.
Right. Hey, this kid swims really fast. Let's let that slide. Hey, this guy sold pudding pops. Let's let it slide. Hey, this guy threw a football really great. Let's let it slide. So yeah, I definitely get that.
May I ask a question to both of you? I admit on the issue of the allegations of rape, I have not delved into it, so I don't really know, how deep this went. But we are in a nation that says, you know, if you are guilty, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
So, did they prove him guilty and just said
no? He was exonerated on all charges.
Okay. So we may not necessarily always like the way our justice system works.
Right.
But according to whatever they're saying we found him not guilty. We didn't have enough to prove he was beyond reasonable doubt. So at that junction, we may not like the outcome, but that was the outcome. I'm not sure why that was the outcome because I haven't delved into it. And if the young lady committed suicide, did she commit suicide because of something else? Or
you know what I'm saying? And I hear that, and I think it's a little – I think it's – like part of me, like the conservative side that you raised me in, like I understand that.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the other side of me that sees cops shoot people, shoot unarmed people. There's video footage. And then the cops get exonerated all the time. And I'm going, we have you on video murdering someone, and then you were exonerating. See, you were exonerated.
We have thoroughly investigated our own actions and found ourselves to be non-negligent.
Right. And so there's that tension again going, okay, I want to see this film. Nate Parker was, you know, exonerated. The young girl killed herself. And I am a person where suicide is self-murder. That is the definition of it. I feel I almost, not all the time, I'm trying to become more compassionate. I was telling a guy today, I said, when you kill yourself, I have less compassion for you than if someone else killed you. Because ultimately, you pick up the gun, you pick up the knife, you turn on the car in the garage, you do whatever it is to take your own life. Are these other things that led to it that people are going to say, hey, you know what, Nate Parker, you might as well picked up the gun. The fact of the matter is Nate Parker didn't pick up the gun. Mm-hmm. And so she did ultimately end her own life. But would she have done that had he not done what he did, if he did what he did? And that's the question now. Exonerated, proven to be, mm-hmm. I guess, not proven to be guilty, not necessarily proven to be innocent.
Mm-hmm.
How do we approach this? Since he was exonerated, I saw the film, but I don't know how to approach something when it's not proven that you're guilty versus someone being exonerated and they're clearly guilty, like with cops.
Well, I mean, maybe a semi-parallel. I mean, like Roman Polanski.
Yep.
Everybody on the planet knows that he was a pedophile.
Mm-hmm.
People still watch his movies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people awarded his film The Pianist the best picture. I believe
while he was in absentia overseas, because if he sets foot in the U.S., mm-hmm. he gets arrested.
I believe did he get best director that year as well? He got best director.
So, I mean,
Woody Allen.
Yeah.
People still go see his films.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bryan Singer, I think he was exonerated, but he was accused of raping someone in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still going to go see every one of the X-Men movies that he directs. Now, bear in mind, those are not as important as the movie The Pianist. I think that movie was a masterpiece and needed to be seen, just like I think Birth of a Nation needs to be seen. And so I do wonder if there is a fair bit. I know there's consciousness, and I'm hearing you, Niecy, for sure, but I do wonder if we draw our lines in the sand in a very zigzag way. Like, oh, I'll go see The Pianist, but I won't go see Birth of a Nation. But both directors were accused of the same thing. But one was proven guilty and one was not. Like, mm-hmm. I'm finding people are drawing their lines in the sand very, very haphazardly.
Well, yeah, well, but I mean, and you find people...
Thanks for jumping in here, Dave. I mean, I don't know where Gregoire is.
Yeah, no, but I mean, you find people who, like, I grew up in Virginia, kind of in the same boat, like, you know, getting back to your earlier question, it is a story that's very, very much glossed over and just kind of buried down there. And so you have in the pop culture mindset, maybe there aren't people, or maybe there are people who don't want this story getting out broader. And so an easy way to do that is to go ahead and start running this story and getting it out there, mm-hmm. because as much as, yes, we are supposed to be living in a society where you are innocent until you are proven guilty, mm-hmm. the practical application thereof is not necessarily that. You know, it's not, you know, OJ found innocent, wasn't really doing any more Hertz commercials once he got off, you know, once he got out of the courtroom. So it's, you know, it is kind of a double-edged sword there where, you know, yeah, okay, great, maybe not real, but maybe it's a rather convenient time for that story to have come up, mm-hmm. I guess, put it that mm-hmm. way.
Yeah.
You know, it's, you know, everybody wants to talk about, you know, if Donald Trump weren't running for president, we would have never heard about an 11-year-old audio recording correct. Of his banter with Billy Bush.
Correct.
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't heard anything about that.
BS, because I know you've been on the internet.
Is there video footage?
Yeah,
is there exactly. a sworn affidavit from four right. midgets and...
yeah, exactly. We need an actual affidavit yeah. from the Pope to prove
right, that. Right,
but no, so I mean, it's, you know, it is rather convenient timing that that's coming up. Because if I recall correctly, the girl committed suicide a year and a half ago, maybe okay. 2 years ago, if I recall correctly. Right.
And even in preparation for this, I didn't bother to find out the girl's name to humanize her, which is... the sad statement of the culture we live in. Like, I don't care. It's like, hey.
Well, and a lot of stories don't publish her name because she was an alleged rape victim.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's, okay. you know, some do. Some. I mean, again, it depends on, you know, where you're reading and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, it is, to some degree, I believe, convenient timing that story bubbled up and all of that swirl happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And do you think, too, it, again, affects finances? Okay. Because... in an interview, I think that he did with Lee
Nate
Thomas,
Parker did,
yeah, okay. and Nate Parker did with Lee Thomas, he said he had put most of his money into this. So getting financing was, you know, hard. And so I agree with you, Dave. So it's kind of like, okay, so if we can affect the finances, we can affect the telling of the story.
Well, because, I mean, it's not like Birth of a Nation is Clerks. You know, yeah, Kevin Smith went out and maxed out his credit cards and had a $35,000 right. budget and right. made Clerks. The scale of this is a little bit bigger.
Right. Yeah. yeah. I mean, he funded yeah. himself. I think he did it. I mean, he's been in a number of movies at this point, so he had the money to do it.
Right.
And he still had some other backers, but I believe this film was in some ways crowdsourced. Don't quote me on that. And then also, it was part of the smaller art film circuit, like the Cannes Film Festival and things like that, mm-hmm. and then it got distribution.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not the first person to do this. Even Mel Gibson, you know, before all the anti-Semitic stuff came out, he self-financed The Passion of the Christ,
yeah,
which is the highest grossing R-rated film of all time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he laughed all the way to the bank once that happened. Yeah. But with this one, I'm not given to conspiracy theories. I'm just not that kind of person. You know, everybody in this room knows I'm a fairly rational person. Niecy, you don't know me that well, but hopefully you're hearing some rational thought here. But I do wonder if there's room for films with the white savior, i.e. films like The Help, mm-hmm. right? Which is a great movie. Mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong. I mean, you know, you've seen it, Gabriel. We've talked about that film, and I thought it was good, and you were like, hey, this is what it was like for women in the 1950s and 1960s going in and being the help and raising these people's kids. And so it was a good story, but it's still kind of the white reporter with the heart of gold saving, you know, these black maids. And then 12 Years a Slave, ultimately at the end, Solomon Northrop is saved by his friend from the North, his white friend from the North coming and speaking up on his behalf, right? But with with this kind of film, Nat Turner rising up, those are kind of films that don't get a lot of play. And I feel like the film Amistad only did as well as it did because Oprah Winfrey, you know, had the entire cast on her show back when she was still doing the, I am so dating myself right now. But I almost feel like this film was killed, or they're trying to kill this kind of narrative, given everything that's going on in 2015, 2016 with the shooting of unarmed civilians, predominantly people of color, you know, black and brown bodies. You've got books coming out by Ta-Nehisi Coates, Between the World and Me, in the last year and a half, talking about these kinds of things and the conversations he has to have with his son. I wonder if there was a concerted effort to kill this movie before it got any legs. And they're saying it was a flop. It came in seventh at the box office this weekend. But at the same time, it made more money this weekend in its opening weekend than 12 Years a Slave did in its opening weekend. Mm-hmm. So while it's being called a flop, it's not they're not going broke. He's not going broke on this.
So, right. And here's the answer to the question. So he put in $100,000 of his own money.
Okay, so you just looked this up?
Yeah. Yep.
Cool.
And awesome. There were 22 athletes, including like Tony Parker. I guess Tony Parker and Mike Finley, two NBA players, were the first two that stepped up and said, here's a bag of cash.
Okay.
And then you had some hedge fund guys. So, I mean, basically it's $100,000 of his own money and then $9.9 million that came in from essentially 22 people.
Other funders. Okay. Yeah. All right. Sweet. So do the two – I mean – does that sound off the wall to think that there was a concerted effort? Case in point, I saw a film years ago called The Golden Compass, Philip Pullman, who essentially wrote this series, his Dark Materials, in response to C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia. C.S. Lewis, outspoken Christian, wrote Mere Christianity, series is beloved around the world. The movies weren't that great, but they were doing really well at the theater. And then Philip Pullman said, I wrote this as the anti-Narnia. He is a unabashed atheist, and Christians killed it at the theater. Absolutely squashed it, and it didn't go anywhere. Do you think that is it unreasonable to think that despite the assumed need, and I don't want to take anything away from people who are protesting, but despite the assumed need for protest, of this film, do you think that that is possibly being given fuel to kill this movie in the cradle, given how many movies Nate Parker has had already and these allegations have not come up at all?
I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why I find this so hard, because of the fact that more likely than not, to be honest, it's a lot of these things are coming up specifically because of all the things that you just mentioned. And, you know, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this.
You can say it as raw as you need to. I mean, you don't have to find the perfect words. Just, hey, throw it out there, right?
Well, I'm just thinking in terms of the fact that, like, I wonder if this, to me at least, it just brings it back right around to full circle to the idea that we need more narratives. Because until we have more, not necessarily more to choose from, but more tons of stories like these, we're going to be stuck with, unfortunately, really problematic situations, because let's be real, it goes back right to what we were talking about earlier. People don't want to be held accountable, and people don't want to be reminded or associated with terrible things. And so when something like Birth of a Nation comes up, they're going to take it, and they're going to try to find ways to make themselves not seem as bad.
Okay.
And so it's one of those, it's a fine line, because on the one hand, it's like I am very staunch against rape and rape culture, and I definitely think as a society and as a whole, we definitely need to have more ways to find people accountable and to try to diminish, try to diminish the occurrences of people being exonerated when they were clearly guilty. But at the same time, it's like, you know, we are stuck with an atmosphere or an environment that doesn't have a whole lot of opportunities and for us to tell these kinds of narratives. Mm-hmm. And so it's complicated in that sense. And I think for me personally, I've kind of I guess, found comfort or found a balance in the sense of, like, okay, well, if I decide not to see this movie, or if I do see this movie, it's like it's with the knowledge of this is also happening, and so making sure that I do stand by the idea of accountability, but then also trying to find ways to support others as well who are trying to get this message across. Mm-hmm. So that means going to go see movies like 13th, or trying to find other ways to get more voices into movies and art forms that would support counter-narratives to the white savior complex.
Okay.
Well, and to the point about, you know, not wanting to be reminded about stuff, I mean, I assure you, you know, Bob's family wasn't lining up to buy tickets to see Schindler's List, you know, and when you do, and when you, and...
Because Bob's Walton Spiel, so he's German just in the background, right?
A little German, yeah.
Right.
just a tad. you know, but I mean, it's, you know, when you, that comparison you were making earlier about, you know, how many of these movies do we need? How many of those movies do we need? You know, you look at it, I mean, like, I mean, it's a valid question. I don't know the answer off the top of my head.
As long as the British are the bad guys, you can just churn those out.
Hey, even in Star Wars, I mean, everybody in space, if they have a British accent, they're bad.
Right.
That's reality 101. We know that. still don't really never figure out how that happened. But no, so I mean, like, I mean, think about it. Like, how many quote-unquote Holocaust movies are there really? You know, you've got The Holocaust, which was, I mean, I remember that when I was a kid, and it was extremely powerful. It was a TV movie. It was a two-part thing. My parents sat me down and forced me to watch it. Mm-hmm. You know, same thing with Roots. Same thing with, and then for, you know, you will learn. Sit.
Yes. Schindler's List, The Pianist, The Beginning of X-Men 1.
Right.
Magneto.
Yeah.
Right? Hello, anybody?
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, it's not like there are hundreds, you know, that are out there, because, and I think it is to some degree, you know, people don't like, you know, by and large, movies are escapism. Mm-hmm. in many cases. And so it's, you don't, well, I mean, again, we're talking about the American public in general here, don't like to get hammered over the head with the message. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like I'll have to shoot you a link to this map that I was discussing with Bob and Jeremiah earlier, where it's actually scary about, you know, how much, how the country voted in the last set of elections between Democratic and Republican. And, you know, and you hear blue state and red state, and there really is no such thing. If you look at this map that, like, really breaks it out on bound to a county-by-county mm-hmm. level, it's like playing the floor is lava with the coasts.
Right.
Like that. And it's, you know, and so, you know, it's not that same mindset.
So the Electoral College comes in and is like, let's figure this out.
Yeah, right.
All right. Okay.
Yeah, you know, so, but, you know, it's that same mindset, though, that, you know, you know, not, you know, but we don't really care about, you know, what happened back then. We don't need to know. We don't need to do no learning about what happened with Nat Turner.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because in our books, he ain't no hero.
Right. Yeah, neither is the North. It's the War of Northern Aggression, right?
I told you, like I said, I mean, I grew up in Virginia, you know, it's, I wish I could get my hands on like an old textbook, because I do. I mean, I remember there were textbooks in our school that did not teach it as the Civil War. It was taught as the War of Northern Aggression. All of the battle names had the Southern, like you didn't learn about the Battle of Bull Run. You know, I forget what, and of course, now that I'm using that example, I just
right, you can't remember what they called it.
But I mean, it's, you learned about all of the alt, you know, the Southern names for those battle places, and you know, it, and the further south you go, I mean, Virginia's attached to DC, you know, and I wasn't living like down in Richmond. I was living in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. You know, so, and you know, living, yep. You know, you get down into the Carolinas, get into Georgia, Tennessee, Kentucky. It's oof.
Yeah. Nat Turner brutalized not just his slave masters, but also their children. And so Martin Luther King Jr. makes an easier hero because of his nonviolence, as does Rosa Parks, as does Medgar Evers. I mean, even Malcolm X, to a degree, who championed the arming of black men and women to protect themselves, is easier to stomach because he never actually became violent himself. But Turner killed children. Matter of fact, in his confession, he talks about how they went in, they brutalized and killed and dismembered this husband and wife. I think it was the first house they went to.
Yep.
They got about a mile and a half away, and they realized they left the baby alive in the bassinet. So they went back, and they killed the baby in the bassinet. And most people I've talked to about this film so far have been very much, Yeah, man, I don't care. They killed slave owners. And it's like, yeah, you know, they killed a baby in the bassinet. Ooh, they killed a baby?
Yeah.
Like, and so it's a little bit different, right? And so do you think his willingness to kill children disqualifies him as a hero for black people?
Let me jump in on that one. And this might sound like, ooh, wow, did she really say that?
Let me get ready to isolate this one.
If I'm remembering the story correctly, there was a place called Achan.
Uh-huh.
And God told the people, go in and kill everybody. Even kill their animals.
Yep.
Okay? And I know this may sound odd, but I do get the thinking. The reason for that thinking was, if you generally one generation teaches the next generation,
mm-hmm.
and so if he went in and he killed everybody, left no one alive, it's because the father and the mother are going to teach the children, and the children are going to teach their children. Now, I know that might sound really, really harsh, but I understand why. And
I've asked this question to several people, and that is
a very common answer, and
remembering, he really loved the Bible. He had started, as soon as he could read, he was reading.
Right.
We're
going to talk about that in the next question, so a little spoiler alert.
Okay,
that one,
all right. So I know that might sound like, ooh, gee, the funny thing is,
and Niecy, I want you to get in on this, and Dave, I want you to get in on this as well, since you're now de facto guest. I find that a lot of people who are anti-religious will often point to those kinds of episodes in the Old Testament, mm-hmm. Where, you know, God tells people to go in and just kill men, women, children, and animals. It's like, it just seems like a waste, and why are they doing that? That seems pretty genocidal. But then when I ask them about this, they're like, oh, yeah, I could totally understand going in and killing the baby, because if you leave the baby alive, they're just going to grow up and become a slave owner anyway. Mm-hmm. It's like, wow, so you're the person who last week said you can't believe in a God who does this, but then this week you're totally on board with killing children because you understand.
See, and that's not how I take that. So you know me and my religious background,
right?
You know, so like I take that as, you know what? Yes, I do know what Old Testament God is like. And so if you buy into the Nat Turner was having visions and was right. acting in that context.
Right. That's the next question. We'll get to that in a second.
Oh, sorry.
No, so it's okay. It's good.
But then it makes perfect sense that that's what he did, mm-hmm. because that's in line with that school of thought.
Right.
Exactly.
Not that it's, oh, the religion bad, but that's okay. It's that, oh, well, that part of religion bad, and, well, they're doing the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like, what I'm saying is you disagree with it here, but then you totally understand it here. Like, you're...
I disagree with both, but...
Oh, see, you're... You disagree with both. I'm saying I've talked to people mm-hmm. who have chastised and indicted God, and the Christian God specifically, mm-hmm. because he called the Hebrews to do this, the
right.
Jewish people to do this. Mm-hmm. But then when I bring up Nat Turner, they're like, oh yeah, I totally understand that. Go in and kill that baby. And it's like, well, a minute ago you indicted God for doing that, and now you're playing God over here, right?
So if you remember Sunday, the way that conversation flow went, it was, oh, well, you know, whoever is going to, you know, eventually wind up raising that baby is probably likely going to be somebody close by that's probably
right.
also a slave owner, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. Okay, great, but what if the family lived in, say, Michigan? You know, or, you know, the family lived in, say, New York, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, the baby was going to be taken away from that environment. Is the answer then still the same?
Right.
Because, again, it's, you know, I mean, you're talking about a baby in a basket. You're not talking about it, you know, a tween or a teen, you know, who's had mass indoctrination
right.
and, mm-hmm. and that which is acceptable and not.
Right. You're talking about a clean slate, essentially.
Right. You know, right. So it's a little harder to some extent. You know,
right.
Does it necessarily make him not, you know, a hero? No. Does it kind of tarnish the image a little bit? Yeah.
Now, one of the interesting things, I think in our generation, we're a lot, I won't call it softer, but more sensitive to things like this. Like, hey, you know what? Two wrongs don't make a right, right? That's what we say these things. But in this graphic novel,
we live in Michigan, right. So three rights make a left.
True story. So those who are not in Michigan will not get that. They're like, I don't find why that's funny. The graphic novel that I read, Nat Turner by Kyle Baker, fantastic. If you haven't read it, please get it. And it's actually, there's really not much to read. The confession is there entirely, but it's told in pictures. Otherwise, there's no words in the picture boxes. It's just, you just see what's happening. And when they realize they're a mile away, and I'm reading the confession, Nat Turner, it's imagined by Kyle Baker, he imagines what is in the confession, that I remember them taking my wife and my son away from me. So I'm going to go do to them what they did to me and what they are doing to our people consistently. Mm-hmm. And so they didn't do that in the film. They didn't show this in the film. They didn't show the killing of children in the film. Mm-hmm. They showed his wife being raped. And so that was the catalyst, rather than his wife and children being taken away. And then he goes and kills kids. It's only adults killed in the film, which I felt was a huge miss, because I felt people need to wrestle with the fact. Well, no, I mean, I get it. I get why they didn't.
Yeah.
You don't shoot dogs. You don't kill. Yeah. You don't kill babies in movies.
Probably nobody would have gone to.
Given this type of, I mean, but you can show black people swinging from trees. So I mean, that's kind of like, all right, hold on. Where are we drawing the line in the sand against a very zigzag line? But I feel like it was a miss in that. I mean, obviously you can't kill a baby, but I feel like people are not allowed to appropriately wrestle with what happened now. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I go back to the historical inaccuracies. I felt like that was something powerful that needed to stay in the film and did not stay in the film. And so some people, the only experience they're going to have with Nat Turner is going to be the film.
Mm-hmm. Inevitably.
And so I feel like something is lost by not having that in there, because I need people to, not I need, I think people need to wrestle with, is he hero, is he villain, do we accept the good, the bad, and the ugly, and how atrocious was slavery that the response to it was just as brutal. Mm-hmm. But Niecy, I feel like I'm talking a lot, and I might be saying something that you're going to say anyway, so hop in here. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's actually kind of all the lines I wanted to go on, is because the fact that I think it's important for people to a certain degree, I feel like by talking about that part of the story and talking about the fact that he murdered children, in a sense, humanizes him. Because of the fact that it goes to show, I mean, most of us can't fathom ever killing a child. But I feel like if they had left it in the movie, it goes to show, it's like, this was so terrible that they were willing to do the unthinkable in order to be free from it.
Mm-hmm, right.
And by taking that away, it's like, well, people don't get to see that part. And, you know, if you think about, you know, your significant others or loved ones being taken away from you or being killed, or watching those that you grew up with, you know, like you said, being lynched, murdered, stabbed, you know, whipped. Like, how most of us, for the most part, would probably want to seek that kind of revenge and want to seek out that sort of justification and those feelings of anger, those feelings of just utter sorrow and devastation would be more accurately represented if they had left that in the film.
Probably, but I think leaving it out changes it from, I mean, you look at it from a from 20 episodes or 20 seasons of Law and Order. That's what, you know, leaving that out takes it from murder one to manslaughter. Because, you know, if it had been in the heat of the moment as they're storming through the house and the baby gets killed, that's one thing. It's that they left the house, they were a mile and a half down the road, mm-hmm. not, you know, and then had to make the conscious decision
to go back.
Oh yeah, let's go back and kill the baby. Mm-hmm. That doesn't tell the narrative that the movie's trying to tell.
Right.
Right. But I think that's part of the issue, is the fact that you need to have, and I think if they left it in, it would have opened it up for discussion. And I think that's one of the things that people don't necessarily think about. It's like, okay, well, you have this group of people who are essentially trying to fight for their mere survival and their livelihoods. And the fact that they have to make the conscious decision of like, okay, well, if we leave the baby behind, that puts us all at risk. And just having to grapple with the fact that they had to think about that. Most of us aren't going to be put into that kind of position ever. And so, again, by leaving it out, it's just kind of missing a lot of these key pieces that make you consider your perspective on, if nothing else, putting yourself in that place and trying to understand again, how terrible things were.
Yeah.
What would it take for me to have to go and think about doing things that I've never thought about doing?
Gotcha. Right. Right.
Absolutely.
Idea.
So last question I'm going to ask here has to do with the spiritual and religious side of things. And I don't know where everyone I mean, Dave, I know a little bit of your background religiously, but I don't know everybody's.
I gave up being Catholic for Lent 1 year and never went back.
Okay, that's cool. So you're a typical Catholic. So you're a typical Catholic.
Got the knuckle scars to prove it. I went to Catholic school.
Most of my religious conversations with people, because I'm Christian. Went to school for history, went to school for religion, went to school for ministry, all these different things. Most people I talk to about religion are often like, "Well, I was raised Catholic." That's always the first starting. Like, okay, all right. I know where you're coming from. I know where you are now.
No. Don't get me wrong. No. I was raised Catholic in an Italian family.
Oh, yes. Super Catholic.
Yeah. So,
super Catholic.
So, when I say...
Catholic to the second power.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, I've probably...
So, basically, Episcopalians are burning in hell forever.
Right? Catholic light.
Catholic light, right?
Catholic light.
Yeah. Otherwise, a.k.a. not Catholic.
Right.
So, But the last question does kind of play around the edges of the religion side of things. I was actually just on a historical podcast this past Sunday where I talked about God and rebellion, and I talked about different people historically, whether you believe they had an experience with God or not, or whether you think it was just a bad wet burrito. They claim to have these experiences such as Moses and Joan of Arc and Constantine the Great, and then Nat Turner all claim to have these visions from God and then led to some sort of uprising. Out of the four that I mentioned, the only one that was unsuccessful was Nat Turner's rebellion. It was put down after 2 days. Although they killed 55 to 65 people, and then in retaliation, over 200 black people, whether they had anything to do with it or not, were hung and killed. But slave masters wrongly used the Bible to advocate slavery. Nat Turner used it to justify an uprising that killed men, women, and children. What are your thoughts on the interplay between invoking the name of God, specifically the Christian God, oppression, and violence? And we'll end on this question.
I think you can probably find a reason or a justification for anything you want to do in the Bible if you look hard enough. It's that whole thing where, everybody loves to quote, "Man shall not layeth with another man." But they also forget the part about if you work on a Sunday, you can be stoned to death. Or if you get a tattoo, you're cursed and will burn in hell.
If your clothes have two different fibers in it, then it's an abomination.
Yeah, so it's the picky choosy ones that I have a problem with. Like if you're in, then you're in. Right. It's like that conversation we're having today. If you're in, you're in.
Right.
If you're out, you're out. A lot of things are done in the name of religion that aren't necessarily religious at heart. And I think that's part of the issue. You look at the difference between the Muslim religion in general and the radical nonsense that goes on. Yeah, you might both be looking at the same book, but wow, are you getting two totally different things out of it?
Right.
I don't know that it, kind of like being able to separate the artist from the art. To me, I've gotten to the point with my view on religion. The Bible's a great book of stories that, basically give you instructional elements on how you should live your life to be a good person. They're not, in my view, literal, but they're a good foundation. Well,
some things are definitely literal. There's a lot of history in there, so some things are literal.
But whether the
experience with God is something to be taken literally,
right.
Is that what you're... Okay,
yeah.
All right. I was like, you can't deny Jewish history. That's kind of rude.
Brings us back to the Holocaust movies.
Did the Holocaust really happen in Minnesota? Right? Okay, so...
But no, so I mean, it's, to me, that's what that is. That, if you look hard enough, it's like I joked, after we had our first child. When I introduced Bob as my partner, I'm like, wait, business partner. Let's be clear.
Right.
2016, you have to ask.
Right. Yeah.
You have to ask.
No, so when my wife and I had our first kid, and I'm standing there in front of the baby book section, I rapidly became convinced that if I looked hard enough and leafed through all of them, I would find a book that told me that if you dipped your baby in boiling water, it would be good because it stimulated their nervous system. Like, that's how much contradictory information was out there in these books. to me, that's kind of what the Bible is like in some cases, because it's through the lens of man and then as your interpretation of it as man, mm-hmm. you know. And so, you know, we all know the game, you know, telephone, you know, and my interpretation of what somebody says to me might be completely different by the time it gets to you. Right. There's a, you know, we talked about it on our show a couple of weeks ago. There's a great, like 10-page write-up of the radicalization of Luke Skywalker, that basically shows how Obi-Wan was essentially a radical Islam imam, who isolated him. He was from a family with no father. He
right.
And it just, you know, and walked
then
through
becomes
this.
A terrorist and blows up the Death Star.
Exactly. Right. And it just phenomenal. Right. I mean, just, you know, so again, it's all based on your interpretation, you know, right. From a certain point of view, if you will.
Interesting. And there's a lot I could say. Just having, I'm not going to, because the conversation will get way too long.
Yeah.
I see where you're coming from on that perspective. To be sure. How about you, Niecy? What are your thoughts?
Let me distill
the question for a second though. Because I heard what you were saying, David, but I don't think we got to the purpose. I was on your podcast several months ago at this point, where I talked about how we talked about being black in America. And I talked about how slave owners were misusing scriptures and saying, slaves, you should be obeying your masters. But the Bible actually says those who are slave traders have no kingdom and no place in the kingdom of God. Right?
Correct.
So they're just lying to black people, and don't let them read it.
Okay, because you weren't letting them read.
Right, you don't let us read. And so, I guess that's what it says, right? Well, then,
isn't that how Mormonism got started?
Kind of. Yeah. But Nat Turner was able to read.
Right.
And so actually, there's a scene in the movie where the slave owner is trying to misquote scripture, and Nat Turner gives him actual scripture. And just right back in his face, it really got kind of ugly. And so the question I'm really asking here is, okay, you've got slave owners misusing it and invoking the name of God, and you have Nat Turner actually quoting actual scripture and invoking the name of God, but then doing something just as violent as the slave owners did to them. But it was for freedom. And if you read the Bible says that God sides with the oppressed, and he's the God who's called you up out of Egypt, out of slavery. I called you. That's actually one of the names of God in the Bible. And so he's very much against slavery, and he says that people who are involved in slave trading get to go to hell. They don't get to go to heaven. And so that's what Nat Turner is using, and then he invokes that name in terms of this uprising. But how do you, Niecy, make sense of, you know, whether you believe in God or not? How do you make sense of Nat Turner's visions and invoking of the name of God to justify this slave uprising in Southampton, Virginia?
Well, I mean, I definitely see religion, especially when it comes to things like revolutions or revolts, not necessarily in the moment, but the effects that it has afterwards. And so, like you were saying, you have slave owners who were misquoting the Bible and using it to benefit themselves, but also in order to further instigate oppression. And you have Nat Turner, who is trying to alleviate he and, you know, his surrounding cohort away from it. And so, for me, it's more of the idea of, like, you know, people need to, whatever they end up doing, whether that be religion, whether that be politics, whether that be whatever sense of inspiration because that they need in order to motivate them to, you know, tear off the shackles, to be able to do something for the greater good. And if inevitably it leads to a revolution, or if it leads to what is going to end up happening anyway, or what needs to happen, then, you know, that's one factor of many, especially in this particular story. Like, yes, his story was inspired by visions, and it was inspired by his religious upbringing, but at the same time, it's like, well, if you look at the aftermath of it, it was necessary, and it was one factor. You know, these visions probably wouldn't have occurred if he wasn't a slave in the first place, if he wasn't already being oppressed, if they weren't already being mistreated, then nothing would have happened, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's just one of the many variables that ultimately led to this uprising.
Okay. And Gabriel, we'll let you answer the final question, we'll let you answer this question, then we'll close out the show.
And actually, I don't have much more to add than what Niecy said.
Okay.
Just, Can I, before you close this, I just want to backtrack just a tad because you were talking earlier about the propagation so much of the white savior. And so I do want to say, because I don't know who all gets a chance to hear this, but if there are any writers out there, one of the good things is that I don't know, because I didn't know how many black men at the end of slavery were a part of an organization that took care of other black people who were struggling at the end of slavery. So in tracing one of my ancestors, I was looking at the headstone and I was trying to figure out, you know, or all these things on the headstone, and someone researched it and found out that there was a group of black odd fellows and that their job was to help people coming out of slavery. And so if there's anybody that's writing stories that maybe getting away from the white savior might be to look at other black people who were able to help other black people as they were coming out of slavery. So that might be a movie that someone should think about doing.
A movie about Frederick Douglass, a movie about Harriet Tubman, something like that. Is that what you're...
At the end, they were financially...
Oh, okay.
So helping black people at the end to get on their feet.
Okay.
So, so there was a group of men in New York. It was another fraternal organization, but okay. I know the Odd Fellows in South Carolina for sure were black Odd Fellows, black men helping to support struggling people. So there may have been farmers that made a little bit more money, you know, selling their product. Were able to help other black people to get on their feet.
Was the Odd Fellows an African-American organization?
Yeah, there was a white Odd Fellows,
okay.
And there was a black Odd
Fellows. Because there's a building in downtown Detroit. Buffalo Wild Wing is in it. It's mm-hmm. the largest Buffalo Wild Wing in the company.
Okay.
But it's in an old, if you look right on the front of the building, it says, you know, the Fraternal Order of the Odd Fellows or something like that.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know that.
Because at the time, I didn't know that there was a black Odd Fellows.
Right, it's like black Masons and white Masons.
I only knew that it was white, but... I found this out, and that was what they did, is they helped black people that were struggling because they had made a little bit more, you know, in terms of money. So, you know.
All right, very cool. Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for being willing to engage on this topic. I had no illusions that we would solve racism or make it easier for everyone to just go see this movie amidst the controversy that's going on. I personally think it's a movie that's worth seeing, but I also will not say that you absolutely have to go see it if you feel convicted otherwise because of the allegations that are surrounding Nate Parker's personal life. Having seen it, I do think it is a worthwhile film. It's done very artistically, great acting, great soundtrack, and great plotting. It's a film I think needs to be told, or a story I think needs to be told, but I understand not everyone going to see it. Either way, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for all of you being here tonight, taking time out of your busy schedules to talk about this film. And I am your host, Calvin Moore. Thank you so much for listening to Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. You can check us out on the Podcast Detroit Network. And you can also find us on iTunes, Leading Questions with Calvin Moore. See you next week. I'm